From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
1,000 strikeouts.
A standing ovation for Pedro Martinez, an instant fan favorite here at Fenway. They have embraced this young man from the Dominican Republic.
If there's one major American sport where Latinos dominate, it's baseball. Today, we learn why that's true. From Cubans using the game as a form of rebellion against Spain.
You have 9, 10 men on a side, you know, struggling for a common ideal. Each individual have their turn to step to the plate. And they use this as a metaphor for democracy and nation, that we all work together as a community.
To immigrant Latinos looking for a chance at the major leagues, the past, present, and future of Latinos in baseball, and what that says about our country. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, listeners, before we dive into this great episode of Latino USA about baseball, here's a couple of questions. When does learning begin? And are we at the end of privacy? What does the road from curiosity to discovery actually look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So, my dear listeners, we discuss lots of topics on this show. But today, I feel like it's time we step up to the plate and address something we rarely talk about. Now, it's a bit of a curveball, one that might even seem like it's coming out of left field. But I want to make sure that we cover all of our bases. Okay, I'm talking, of course, about baseball, or baseball, which is something I don't know much about. But hey, that's okay, because my producer, Michael Simon Johnson, is here to help me out.
Hey, Maria.
Hey, Michael.
So, right off the bat, you're right. We don't cover sports, certainly not baseball very often. But the truth is, for a lot of non-Latinos like myself who grow up in white America, baseball is sometimes our first encounter with anything Latino. I mean, a lot of the famous Latino men in the collective mainstream American consciousness are athletes, in particular, baseball players. You know, think A-Rod, Sammy Sosa, Jose Canseco.
Right. So if you're not Latino, you don't even have to know any Latinos to know who those people are.
Exactly. Obviously, not everyone cares about sports, but whether we like it or not, sports get in our faces. I grew up in Pittsburgh, where there was a really small Latino population. And for a long time, the only Latino man that I could name was Roberto Clemente. I mean, he's just a legend in Pittsburgh, but that's all that we had. It was just him.
Okay.
This means that baseball can affect the visibility of the Latino community in surprising ways. And in that sense, baseball is worth talking about. And if you don't believe me, here's a story to help illustrate my point.
Okay.
I'm bringing in Julio Ricardo Varela. Julio is our digital director here and the founder of Latino Rebels.
I want to set this up. It's like...
It all starts with his childhood love of the Yankees.
I devoured the New York Yankees. I came from Puerto Rico to the Bronx when I was in the 70s, when the Yankees were actually good. My grandfather knew George Steinbrenner, so I had the sweetest tickets. I went to the 1977 World Series that they won, 78.
Game 6 of the 1977 World Series between the Dodgers and the Yankees, with the Yankees leading 3-2.
I met Mickey Mantle, like I met Joe DiMaggio, I met them all.
And to throw out the ceremonial first pitch, the roar for the Yankee clipper, Joe DiMaggio.
You know, I lived about 20 minutes up in the Bronx on Marshall Parkway, and you just hop on the 4, and you're down on 161st Street, and you're paying $10 and watching the game. The Yankees were my life. I mean, I am, you know, the poster child of the Yankee fan of the 70s. I was hardcore.
All right, so in high school, Julio's applying to colleges, and he gets into Harvard. And he heads up to Boston, better known to a Yankees fan as enemy territory. If you know nothing about baseball, then you should know that historically, the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees, it's one of the oldest, fiercest rivalries in all of American sports.
Out of the bullpens, they're coming now. Both bullpens out.
Mickey Rivers is the guy that's trying to hit everybody with a sucker punch.
So even when I went to Fenway Park as an undergrad, it was, you know, I went to a Yankees Red Sox game, and I was like, of course I'm a Yankees fan. And it's like, don't go to Fenway Park. Like, I had my Bronx on.
In 1996, the Yankees win the World Series again.
The Yankees are champions of baseball!
Julio's pumped.
And I was like all over it. I put a poster up in my work.
So Julio's being, you know, an annoying Yankees fan in Boston. But it wasn't just being on the other side of the rivalry that made showing up in Fenway Park so transgressive. It was also just being Latino.
Why is that?
Well, Fenway Park, the Red Sox, they have a long history of racial exclusion.
This team, this city, was the last club to integrate 12 years after Jackie Robinson.
That's Alan Klein. He's a professor of anthropology and sociology at Northeastern University in Boston.
12 years. We were the last. This progressive bastion was the last place to integrate. To me, that's a stain on the city.
Alan says Boston's history of racism in sports extends far beyond just baseball. Take Bill Russell, the legendary basketball player and coach, played with the Boston Celtics in the 50s and 60s and became the first black coach in the NBA. Russell once famously said that there was an unwritten quota system for black players.
You played two blacks at home, which was Boston. You played three on the road, and you played five if you were behind. So, I mean, really what they wanted to do was to win. And they would take five blacks if it meant a win, but they'd rather just take two.
And Fenway Park has probably been the worst offender. You have to understand, Fenway is the oldest ballpark in Major League Baseball. It's classic Americana, red brick. Yawkey Way, the stadium's address, is named after Tom Yawkey, the Red Sox owner who kept black players off his team for as long as he could.
Fenway Park, for lack of a better word, was a very white baseball stadium. And there was an ugly history to that. Black people didn't go to baseball games. And, you know, Latinos didn't go.
Then in the mid-80s, there's the infamous case of Tommy Harper, the black first base coach who publicly exposed the Red Sox and their ongoing relationship with a whites-only Elks club in Florida, where the Red Sox had spring training. This was 1985. The point is, Boston was not the friendliest place to be if you weren't white, athlete, coach, or fan. So you got Julio, a diehard Yankees fan from multicultural New York, living in the middle of a very white Red Sox nation, going to games. Meanwhile, in the mid-90s, the Red Sox snagged a new infielder.
Nomar Garcia Parra. Garcia Parra?
Yeah.
Like, there's nobody named Garcia Parra in Boston.
So in Nomar's first ever Major League Baseball game, on his very first hit.
He had a very rough road trip. Is this number one for Garcia Parra?
He hits a home run. I mean, it was as strong a premiere as you could possibly have.
And he's billed as sort of the phenom for the Red Sox.
This guy, they say, is the real deal.
Boston just was like, Nomar!
You know, there was that SNL skit with Jimmy Fallon where he made fun of the Nomar craze.
Nomar Garcia Parra! Nomar! Yeah!
Like, they were just so into it. And what attracted me to Garcia Parra was, is that he wasn't the typical, prototypical Boston athlete.
Wait, what does that mean, prototypical Boston athlete?
Well, as you can imagine, Boston's sports heroes had been mostly an assortment of white guys like Larry Bird, Ted Williams, Bobby Orr.
And here was this Latino ball player, and he just captivated the city. But then came the greatest, like, pitcher I've ever seen in my life live. And that's Pedro Martinez.
A standing ovation for Pedro Martinez, an instant fan favorite here at Fenway. They have embraced this young man from the Dominican Republic.
There's so much about Pedro that just captivated me. First of all, showing up in Fenway Park, I saw all these Dominican flags.
I like to live in the streets of San Pedro de Macorís.
And the fact he had attitude, he was brash, like, who's your daddy? And then when he was pitching, like, you know, that was the height of Juan Luis Guerra and 440, the merengue band. And they would play, like, you know, I like to live in the streets of San Pedro de Macorís. And that's playing on the speakers in Fenway Park.
And Julio wasn't the only one who noticed the change in atmosphere. Here's Alan Klein again.
There was a tremendous outpouring of Dominican and other Latino pride in his presence here. And they brought that fervor, that energy to staid, boring white Fenway Park. It was really quite stunning to see.
And you're like, this is so surreal, but it was inherently cool. Because as a Puerto Rican, like, kid who grew up in San Juan with baseball, this is the baseball that I know.
And it wasn't just the stadium that was changing either. It was the whole city.
All of a sudden, like in 1999, I walk into like a packy, like they say, a package store, which is a liquor store in Boston. And all of a sudden there's like Presidente beer, like in places where there were no Latinos. And that's all because of the Dominican influence. So there was a part of me that was like really into the fact that this athlete, Pedro Martinez, owned Boston.
Yeah.
And then you fast forward to the year where, you know, David Ortiz comes.
2003.
Big Poppy.
Ortiz drives into deep center. Sizemore hit it back. It's up. Down. Ortiz does it again.
David Ortiz, this imposing Afro-Dominican, looks cool, acts cool, and he's a designated hitter, which means his sole job is to just crank out hits. And he delivers.
Like, David Ortiz will be
one of those.
You know, they might name a tunnel after him. He could probably run for mayor of Boston. And all with all this, like, he just has a way. You see him, his presence. People just like, ah, Poppy. Poppy, yeah. Noma and Pedro. Like, that's the Holy Trinity.
So it sounds like the sort of the presence of Pedro and David and David Ortiz.
David Ortiz.
And Nomar and all this stuff. It sort of okayed Latino pride,
yes,
in the city. Outed it. Like, it's cool. Like, you can come out from hiding.
That's exactly what you're saying, Michael. It's like, it's come out. It's like, we're no, you know, come to the ball game.
And Alan Klein actually published a really enjoyable sociological paper about what he calls the Latinization of Fenway Park.
Pedro comes along at precisely the moment in time here in New England when Dominicans, even Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, all began to be here in larger and larger numbers.
It sort of reinforced to me the connections I had growing up as a kid in Puerto Rico with baseball. That was always in our fabric. So for me, getting to Boston being transformed, coming out, as you say, was like a big deal. So I just said, I'm a Red Sox fan.
One day in July 2004, Julio and his daughter are back in the Bronx watching the Red Sox play the Yankees.
And it's the game where...
It's kind of infamous now. There was a huge fight on the field between some of the Yankees and Red Sox.
Classic game. The Red Sox were down by like a gazillion runs. They came back and Bill Miller hits his home run. And my daughter goes, yes. And I go, yes. And the bartender, who's like Irish, Bronx, probably from Bainbridge Avenue, like, you know, looks at me,
yeah,
arms crossed, like a drama, like out of like Miller's Crossing. And then my uncle's next to me goes, yeah, he's a Red Sox fan. And he grew up in the Bronx. And the bartender paused, looked at me like as if I killed his entire family, like just shot them down. He goes, you're such a Bronx Judas.
Coming up after the break, Michael takes us to the Baseball Hall of Fame to find out how baseball reached Latin America in the first place. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Con los éxitos.
Hey, listeners, it's Maria, and I hope you're enjoying our special episode on baseball. I know I learned a lot, mostly because I don't know anything about baseball. But before we continue, I want to ask you to take a moment to rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Now, many of you have done this already, and really, it's a huge help towards welcoming new listeners and getting our show out there. And if you can, go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. All of the small donations that we get from dedicated listeners like you really help us to tell the big, overlooked stories like the ones you're hearing today. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S, with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions at InadaUSA.com. That's InadaUSA.com. And the Gruber Family Foundation, supporting NPR's international coverage, which seeks to help bring the world's news home and provide listeners with a compelling and clear outlook of complex global issues.
You know, I'm here longer than any player.
I grew up right here in the Bronx. I was born here 71 years ago. I was a Giant fan. We used to walk over to the Polo Grounds. When they just left us, we became Yankee fans. Yeah, since 1958. I've seen every great game played here. Yeah, Latino players are the greatest.
My uncle, Ed Figueroa, pitched for the Yankees. He's the youngest brother of my father's side. There were 11 brothers and sisters. You know, he was the first Puerto Rican-born pitcher to win 20 games in the major leagues, and still is. There is no other.
We're having a good time looking at the game here. We're sitting down on the benches and talking about baseball, and this is a priority for us. For each game, well, I just look at it. When the Yankees come and have a nice batting and they give home runs, I jump for joy. But when they lose, you see me crying. And it's not nice. I get mad with the Yankees when they lose.
I'm actually half Puerto Rican, so I love the fact that there's so many Latinos and Hispanic people playing baseball. It makes me proud of my heritage and proud of my culture.
If you don't have Latinos playing the game won't be the game. I'm sorry. It's just the truth. It's just the truth. And we are the only ones that keep flair in the game, doing all the dives, passing, tossing the ball backwards and stuff. So it brings a lot of fun. We bring the lust in the fans. And the fans want to come see that. Why not?
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm back in the studio with our producer, Michael Simon Johnson. He just explained to us how the Latino population in Boston actually became more visible through baseball.
Yeah, and here's another thought. When you think of a Latino sport, you might think of soccer. But consider this. Of the four major American sports leagues,
football, basketball, baseball, hockey,
of those four, baseball has hands down the largest number of Latinos. And by that, I mean both U.S.-born Latinos and foreign-born Latin Americans. I mean, one quarter of Major League Baseball players come directly from Latin America, which is just unprecedented.
Wow. And this is America's pastime that we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, America's pastime, just like America itself, is getting Latino-er and Latino-er.
Okay. I realize I don't even know how baseball actually became so popular around certain parts in Latin America.
Yeah, well, I reached out to Adrian Burgos, a professor at the University of Illinois, who's written a number of books on the history of baseball. He originally thought what many people might think.
Baseball's popularity and development in the Caribbean, in Latin America, must have been attached somehow to U.S. military imperialism.
Which makes sense. I mean, the U.S. has been so deeply involved in the Caribbean. people would think that it was the U.S. that brought it there. Of course, the truth is much more complicated. All right, so let's jump way back in time to the mid-1800s. Cuba was under Spanish rule, in spite of several failed attempts to gain independence from Spain.
And so what we see in the 1860s is that those who supported the struggle for a free Cuba against colonial Spanish rule began to send their kids to study at the high school and the college level to the United States.
Cuban parents were sending their kids to American universities, like Fordham University in New York.
The importance of this was they're removing the next generation outside of the cultural hold of the Spanish rulers.
So these Cuban students, future leaders of their country, are studying here in the United States. Guess what sport was all the rage here in the 1860s?
Oh, baseball?
Yep. The students pick it up here.
And they bring baseball back, and they gave it lots of meaning that this is the sport of Cubans. This is not Spanish.
But what were the Spanish playing in terms of sports?
Well, there was bullfighting, and Cubans were rejecting even that association with Spain.
Because of the magisterial matador who stands against the beast and executes his grace and his power over nature.
One strong man against a single enemy. As opposed to baseball, which was
9-10 men on a side, you know, struggling for a common ideal. And they use this as a metaphor for democracy and nation, that we all work together as a community.
So baseball just explodes.
We're standing right now on a map of the Caribbean.
So recently, I took a trip with another producer, Daisy Rosario.
An awesome trip to Cooperstown, New York, home of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I've always wanted to go.
At the Hall of Fame Museum, we met John O'Dell, the curator of history and research.
He showed us a new exhibit called Viva Baseball, which chronicles the history of the game throughout Latin America.
As you can see, it looks different than the whole rest of the museum. It's got a lot of bright colors.
Like we said, baseball's popularity in Latin America begins with Cuba.
The Cubans ended up taking baseball with them throughout the Caribbean, wherever they went.
To the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Mexico, Panama.
But now we get to the ugly history of Latino players coming here, to the U.S. So while Cuba brought the sport to parts of Latin America, the United States was going through the process of taking this very popular leisurely activity and turning it into a business.
Over the years, leagues form, teams represent major cities, and fans tune in on the radio.
One more bite, one more swallow, and that four-course Yankee dinner will be safely tucked away under the Tiger Belt. You know,
and the thing is, everybody loves baseball. But, like much of American life at the time, the game is segregated.
We're talking about baseball's infamous color line.
The invisible line that divided the white major leagues from the Negro leagues.
Now, one of the craziest things about the color line is that, unlike Jim Crow laws or segregation laws that were actual laws in the books, baseball's color line didn't officially exist. It wasn't written down. People thought that white audiences would never accept a black player, so no matter how talented they might be, black players weren't allowed on white teams.
Here's Adrian Burgos again.
Baseball's color line operated from 1889 to 1946.
And before Jackie Robinson famously broke the color line?
We had 53 Latin American and U.S.-born Latinos that participated in the major leagues.
A small number of Latinos were bending it.
There was the split of, if you were a darker-skinned Latin player, you wouldn't be signed by a major league team, you'd be signed by a Negro Leagues team. If you were lighter-skinned, you'd be signed by a major league team.
Just like today, Latinos 100 years ago came in every shade. So this process of being split up was a very strange experience for the Latin American players.
The professional baseball in Latin America was always integrated. They did not have a color line. And so you had the dimension where Latinos who were teammates on teams in the Cuban League or in the Dominican League played in different leagues entirely when they came to the United States.
Many Latin American players were coming to the U.S., and the vast majority were Afro-Latinos, so they played in the Negro Leagues.
We can say about 10 to 15% of the Negro Leagues were Latino players.
And it went the other way, too. The African-American players who weren't allowed in the majors would often go to foreign leagues in the offseason, to Mexico or Cuba, and play in integrated leagues with players of all different colors, something they couldn't do in their own country.
Yeah, it's a lot like maybe the history you've heard about where black American jazz musicians went to Paris, but with Negro League baseball players. They'd go to this other place and be embraced in a way that they just weren't in their own country.
So the light-skinned Latin American players obviously had it much easier once they came here, although they had to go through the unusual process of being racialized.
Yeah, this was a crazy thing we learned about at the Hall of Fame.
Because they were, say, Cuban, the fear was that even if they didn't look black, they might still have African blood in them, and that just wouldn't do. But talent was talent, so managers who wanted to acquire these players simply changed the language around how the players were presented.
They were presented to the baseball public as, he's not black, he's Cuban. He's not black, he's Puerto Rican.
And in some ways, this worked. Early on, both players and managers recognized how flexible the color line was when it came to Latinos, and they tried their best to take advantage of it. Take the New York Cuban Giants, a team made up entirely of African Americans who, legend has it, would speak gibberish to each other on the field in the hopes of convincing crowds that they weren't black, but rather Cuban.
Then there's the story of the manager who plotted to send black players down to Cuba, have them learn Spanish, and then bring them back up and try to pass them off as authentically Latino. Stories like these were actually a big part of the Viva Baseball exhibit at the Hall of Fame.
Let me show you real quickly a document that is one of my favorites here in the entire museum.
John O'Dell told us about two talented Cuban pitchers, Rafael Almeida and Armando Marsans, who were being eyed by the Cincinnati Reds in 1910. The question, of course, was,
are these guys dark Latin players or are they white Latin players? And so the Cincinnati Reds sent a scout down to Cuba, and here's his what he said.
John read to us from a scan of the original document.
He said, I know personally both parents of our great ball players, Marsans and Almeida, and guarantee that none of them have any other but pure Caucasian blood in their veins. Their claims to the members of the white race is as good as yours and mine. Signed, Victor Munoz.
Oh, my God.
It's just so open.
It's so official. It's so part of the business, the system of it.
Yeah, exactly. But this, argues Adrian Burgos, is where it all comes back to money. Because those two players, whose Caucasian blood was verified, Marsans and Almeida, once they had played a few seasons with Cincinnati, they started asking for higher pay.
And one of the officials, the team officials of the Cincinnati Reds, while this labor dispute, contract holdout is taking place, informs the press that we did not hire a pair of bronze-skinned Islanders to pay them Honus Wagner money.
Translation, white money. Honus Wagner was a major league superstar in his day.
The essence of that statement was, they want that talent, but they don't necessarily want to pay it the equivalent of what the white American players were receiving.
Basically, because of racism, the desire to exclude black players, major league teams started exploiting talented Latino players.
I mean, even as a baseball fan, and I'm a huge baseball fan and kind of a history dork, it was really amazing to learn all of the things that we did at this exhibit. And it even put Jackie Robinson in a new light for me.
What Jackie Robinson does, that is ultimately the most important thing when it comes to how we understand the color line and its operation, he shatters all the racial ambiguity that 30 years of incorporation of Latino talent had done.
So, Michael, bring us to the present. Why are the numbers in MLB so high today?
Right. Well, to answer that question, we have to visit the 1980s. So MLB decides they need to find a more cost-effective way of getting talented players. So they start looking at the Dominican Republic.
For $100,000 out of Dominican Republic in the 1980s, you could probably sign 20 players. And if one of those 20 players becomes Sammy Sosa, you've made such a great return.
So the DR replaces Cuba as the dominant source of foreign talent. But baseball in Cuba didn't end just because the relationship with the U.S. soured. But the embargo did have an impact. Reporter Dasha Lisitsina was actually just in Cuba, and she wanted to get a sense of what Cuban baseball looks like on the ground now, and how and why so many of their players keep coming to the United States.
Yeah, I went there to try to scope out what the contemporary baseball scene was like, how it was playing out in this very complicated, abstract, Cuba-U.S. political relationship.
So, Dasha, take us to Cuba.
So, in the center of Old Havana, in the Parque Central, there's this statue of the revolutionary poet José Martí, and underneath it, a crowd of men gather at pretty much all times of day to talk about baseball, as fervently as Martí must have talked about revolution.
La esquina caliente. Aquí.
The hot corner is here. It's where people gather and talk about sports, exchange ideas, and we spend time here and we get to know each other and we talk.
These guys are serious fans, but most of the people in the country I talk to can reel off the names of famous Cuban players as easily as the socialist slogans you see everywhere.
Aquí en las series nacionales, me gusta Alfredo Espaine, Cepe, Puy, Pito Abreu.
Julián Quirúrica, Maestro, Angelinos. Sí, Abreu, Cepe, Herrero, Arruena.
Julián, Yacier Puy.
About half of these Cuban stars, Yasiel Puig, José Abreu, Yonés Céspedes, actually play for the majors in the U.S. And they're considered defectors, at least officially.
Well, there are two perceptions here. One is what the people on the streets think, and the other is what the people in the institutions think.
That's Felix Julio Alfonso López, a baseball historian in Havana. López says that, as far as the fans are concerned, there's no longer really a stigma surrounding baseball players who leave Cuba.
But there was a stigma.
Yeah, they weren't shown on national TV. People were very hush-hush about them. And now people are talking about them, for the most part, as if they're heroes.
It was almost like they were like shunned from the society that they had left.
Right, yeah. As far as the government was concerned, they were dead. And it's still a different story for them. Not only that, Major League Baseball isn't even supposed to hire them. But there are loopholes and grey areas. Since 2009... at least 20 so-called defectors have signed MLB contracts worth more than $300 million.
Wow, that is crazy. Why are Cuban players so valuable? I mean, why are they so sought after?
They're still considered among the very best in the world. Before the 1961 trade embargo, Cuba supplied more players to Major League Baseball than all the other Latin American countries combined. And now there are a lot more Dominicans and Puerto Ricans in Major League Baseball. But Cubans are still highly sought after, partly because they've already been trained and they're so difficult to acquire. Besides,
now you could do this legally.
López says that it's easier for the U.S. to recruit Cuban players now than in past years. Here's how they do it.
Professional players emigrating from Cuba are now getting legal residence in third countries. And after that, they're eligible to play in Major League Baseball in the United States.
So they're sort of cheating the system in a way.
Right. So Yunesky Betancourt, for example, got legal residence in Mexico, and then he went on to play for the Seattle Mariners. That was quite a smooth option. But it's not always that easy. In fact, it could be really dangerous. Take Yasiel Puig, for example. He tried to seek legal status in Mexico, but when that failed, he turned to the Zetas drug cartel to get smuggled into the US. And the operation went very wrong. He was held captive in Mexico for about a month. But as soon as Puig arrived in the States, he signed a $42 million 7-year contract with the LA Dodgers. In Cuba, there's mixed opinion about the repercussions of all these great players hitting it big in the States. I talked to a baseball fan in the province of Pinal del Río, Michelle, who has no hard feelings about those who leave.
If they can make it all the way, then we want them to. I want them to be able to express their talent in the U.S., in the major leagues.
But at La Esquina Caliente, the men are not quite as supportive.
Leaving is good for the players, because they get to go play with the best in the world. But it's bad for our league, because all the good players leave.
And that shows no signs of changing. There's this Citadel Esportiva in Havana. It's a huge crumbling sports academy for kids where young athletes train to play for the National Series. Two teenagers there, Ernesto Cabrera and José Puig, no relation to Yasiel, say they have another ultimate aim in mind.
We want to play for the National Series because this is my country, and I started playing ball in my country. Once I get better, I'll go there, to the United States.
Why is the desire so strong to go to the United States?
Just look at the numbers. All the players in the Cuban National Series, just over 500 guys, make a combined $60,000 a year. Meanwhile, the starting salary for a single MLB player is $500,000 a year. Of course, Cuba National Series games are much cheaper to watch. The cost of entry is purely symbolic, 1 Cuban peso. That's about 4 cents. But Cuban baseball is edging its way to becoming a little more commercial. The Cuban government, which runs the whole baseball shebang, has been renting out players to Japan and China and other countries for a bit of extra cash. Lopez hopes that, with improving Cuba-US relations, Cubans might soon be able to play in the major leagues as well as the Cuban League.
The Cuban tournament is at a different time of the year. That's why it doesn't interfere with MLB. In the past, many Cuban baseball players played in the Cuban Professional League in the winter, and then they would go and play in MLB. I think that would be the healthiest option.
It would certainly prevent crazy cases like Yasiel Puig's from happening again. But at the moment, no one is actually talking about the solution yet. And until then, the Cuban players who are keen to commercialize their talent will keep trying to leave for Major League Baseball any way they can.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. But, well, thanks, Dasha.
You're very welcome.
You know, I really had no idea how close Cuba's baseball history is tied up with our own. All right, coming up, or rather, on deck, we go to Washington State to find out what life is like for young immigrant athletes in the minor leagues. It's coming up. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. So before we get back into our look at the past, present, and future of Latinos in baseball, here's a couple of questions. When does learning begin? And are we at the end of privacy? What does the road from curiosity to discovery actually look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org.
You know what? I grew up with the Dodgers since I was a kid. Pops, moms. This is where we had our birthdays, and we grew to it. Every day on the radio, Vin Scully, Channel 5, that's why we love it.
Fernando Valenzuela, Pedro Guerrero, Vin Scully, all the old school people, you know what I mean? Fernando's the one that set the standard for for the Hispanics.
I love the Dodgers because they're the hometown team, and me and my family's been Dodgers fans for 20, 30 years, you know?
Baseball. Baseball is my favorite sport. We grew up with it. It's what we love. It's where we come out to.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So today we've been focusing on baseball And as we've heard, the major leagues rely heavily on foreign players for their talent. But just getting to the majors is another story. Everyone is filtered first through the minor league system. It's a necessary step for anyone trying to make it in the big leagues. Upwards of half of all players in the minor leagues are foreign players, and most of them come from the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, and a handful of other Latin American countries. But what is it actually like, not just to be an immigrant, but to come for a very specific purpose, to try to succeed in professional baseball? Our producer, Michael Simon Johnson, takes it from here.
Kim Izaguirre-Merlos, freelance contributor to Latino USA, she documents everyday life in professional baseball. Last summer, she stopped into her hometown ballpark, Gisa Stadium in Pasco, Washington. It's the home of the Tri-City Dust Devils, rookie ball team associated with the Colorado Rockies. She embedded herself in the bleachers for a season to answer exactly that question. What is the experience of coming from Latin America trying to make it in the big leagues?
Good evening and welcome to Gisa Stadium for Tri-City Dust Devils Baseball. I'm Chris King, and thanks for joining us tonight as the Dust Devils begin a three-game series at home with the Spokane Indians.
It's August 13th, 2014, at 7 p.m. It's a home game against our division rival and first-half champs, Spokane Indians. And if we win, we take the lead in the division. But we're coming off the toughest road series in the travel schedule. We're back from Canada. Basically, that means like we're running on little to no sleep. I came into the broadcast that night right at this moment.
Welcome back to Gisa Stadium here. If you're just joining us on the broadcast, a very unfortunate scene here as we had a collision out in right center field.
Your heart just like drops right into your stomach.
Between two Spokane Indians players.
And you're imagining two guys running at full speed, no pads on, right? Taking each other out, and they're just lying crumpled over on the field.
Presumably waiting on an ambulance to come here out at the ballpark.
You're like waiting for 27 minutes.
And so the game is just like on hold for about a half hour.
Yeah.
Listening to Dust Devils Baseball on News Talk 870 KFLD.
So the game keeps going after the collision, and would see a total of three ambulances called to the ballpark on three separate occasions. A monsoon would start dumping down, and so, like, with all the delays, it would run a little over 5.5 hours to 1 a.m., 14 innings.
Did you guys win?
Not in time! The Dust Devils win it! A 14-inning marathon!
Yeah, we did win. 8-7, the longest, craziest game of the season. Here's what's interesting, though.
These guys didn't get in to town from Vancouver till 6 in the morning yesterday.
So on top of baseball, these guys also have to fit in class, English class.
Like school.
Yeah, like school, like education. They've only been in the country maybe two seasons. So they're still pretty new to the country.
There's no question that you guys are exhausted. Like, you don't have to convince me.
After the game, they remember, like, wait, we've got this thing that we're supposed to be at tomorrow. And they're going back and forth, all the players, like, well, you know, by the time we get home, it's going to be 3 a.m.
No, they're just deciding to break the rules, basically.
We have to learn English to be able to communicate. But right now, this is a moment where they're like, dude, we just played, you know, 14 innings. And English class, tomorrow is 7 a.m. I'm not so sure about that. It's 8:10 a.m. Class starts in 10 minutes. Everybody is here back at the ballpark. Jairo Rosario, Carlos Yan, Oscar Brazban, Helmus Rodriguez, the team's eighth. We're in the stadium parking lot, except for one guy. We're going to call him JP for reasons that I'll get to shortly.
And then he already called Helmies, like,
so that's Josh Rosenthal. He's the cultural development coordinator for the Colorado Rockies.
These guys are leaving. They said they're on their way.
Okay.
He's talking to Eric Johnson, their English teacher. And then you can hear Jairo, like, all the way, because Jairo's, like, over in another car.
Ah, boy. Yo soy gringo.
He's like, no, man, I'm on gringo time and I don't get paid overtime.
We got to get out of here.
Yeah, it's a gringo hour. They should be used to the schedule. You guys are really time-oriented, man.
Which brings me to the reason why we're using JP instead of the guy's real name. Because as you might imagine, not showing up for work can be dangerous for a player's career.
So let's go in our cars.
All right,
Eric's like, all right, let's go. And they pull out without JP.
Right this way, gentlemen, right this way.
Follow those two girls right there. Follow those girls.
I want to say that if these guys come across sleepy at all, they played last night 15 innings.
Okay, so now we're in Eric's intro to anthropology class with eight other students that the guys have never seen or talked to before.
And here's how it'll work. I'll give you about 5 minutes and go ahead and have your conversation, and then we'll have you guys rotate so you'll get to meet everybody. Okay?
Why are they bringing the two classes together?
The guys are always at the ballpark, right? They never do stuff like this. It's just, I wake up, I go to the ballpark. If I have some free time, I might walk down to the grocery store down the street, and then I go right back to the ballpark all day long.
So it's just really meant to break them out of their tiny little world.
So what's your name?
Brasova.
What?
Brasova.
Oh, okay.
What's your name?
Huh?
What's your name? Your name?
Take a guess. No, no, that's not my name. No, I'm kidding. Well, hi, I'm Haley.
What?
I said, hi, I'm Haley.
Hi?
Haley. Yeah.
Haley.
Tyler.
Okay.
Your favorite food from where you're from?
From Dominican Republic.
My favorite food from Dominican?
Uh-huh.
Beans, rice, and cheese.
That's what everybody says.
So, at one point, the thing that struck me, like, as I looked around the room, this really might be the only time that these guys will ever find themselves in a college classroom as students, because every player confronts the truth. It's either baseball or school at some point along the way to their dream.
And that's what I knew when once.
So fast forward to the end of class.
You know, I knew how exhausted they were last night, but I knew that when it was said and done, they were going to be happy about it and happy they did it.
The mood is like really light and fun, you know? And Josh and Eric are talking in a corner of the class.
There will be consequences for him not being here, you know, and just is what it is.
And bigger picture consequences, you know, bro.
Mm-hmm.
Because the guys are going to say how much fun they had.
That's the best part. Yeah.
And it's on the drive home when Josh tells the guys, for all of you in a few years, when someone asks, like, who can vouch for him? Is he responsible? Is he a professional? When, like, decisions get made, calls up, whatever. All we've got is our reputation, our actions.
Manzana.
There's an apple tree, and it's the first time that Helmus is seeing an orchard.
Si tú podrías aprovechar, hablar con un compañero para traerte.
Ay, Dios mío, mira. Eso me gusta a mí, teacher.
Yeah, again, that's Helmuth. He sees a moped, and he loves them, right? Because he has one back home.
¿Tú tienes moto como es eso?
Sí.
Josh makes a comment about mopeds, and
cuidado, tú tienes una hija.
He says to, you know, he says to Helmuth, hey, be careful, you have a daughter.
Sí, una hija.
And so it reminds Helmuth of life, of his baby daughter back home.
Do lots of guys have families back home?
Yeah, a lot of guys do actually have their own families back home. Helmus is only 20 years old and he's already got a baby daughter.
Teacher.
Thank you, teacher.
Good job.
Hey, you guys, great job today.
So this was back in August, right?
Yeah.
What happened to these guys? I mean, what happened to Brazoban? A year later, where are they?
He finally, you know, got what every guy here wants. He got the call up.
The call up to a higher level.
Yeah. He got the call up to Modesto, which is three levels below the big leagues.
So he's one step closer to playing Major League Baseball now. What happened to that guy, JP, who didn't show up?
So JP finished out the season two. He came back for spring training and was released at Extended this year.
Released?
Yeah, they let him go.
So what's he doing now?
Imagine he's back in the DR, trying to figure out what to do next.
My name is JJ Estevez, and I am an assistant player development for the Washington Nationals Baseball Club. And some of the responsibilities that I have in, with this position is I'm mainly the go-to guy for all the Latin American players that we have here. I help them out with everything they need, mainly off the field. During spring training, when we have all of our players here, I would say that we have around like 50 or 55 Latin American players. Sometimes it can be more, it can be less. My understanding is that 1 out of 100 usually makes it to the big leagues. Our goal is to try to make every single one of these guys, you know, make it to the big leagues. But at the same time, we also want to encourage them, you know, to develop as human beings, you know, and as professionals, because they, out of this experience, they can take a lot of things that will help them in their future. For example, how should they behave in a hotel when there are other guests there? How to follow programs here in the clubhouse, schedules, bus times, things like those, you know, how to work with teammates, you know, how to address your staff. It's just there are things that it's not that they do wrong where they come from. It's just that it's a little different, and it has to do with the culture here. A lot of them, they're, you know, they have legal status here in the United States, and, you know, they end up staying with their families here. Unfortunately, most of them, they end up going back there. And since the higher percentage of these guys, they don't complete not even high school education. So them going back there, you know, it's starting life all over again. A lot of them actually go back home. You know, they try to try out again for the teams, and sometimes they get a second chance.
If you've ever watched a major league game in Español, you've probably heard Ernesto Jerez and his signature home run call.
La pelota en dirección hacia territorio del jardín derecho. ¡A lo profundo! Y no, 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 no.
Ernesto has been broadcasting for almost 20 years, and recently he even took home a sports Emmy for his work. For today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom, Ernesto, a native of the Dominican Republic and a lifelong baseball fan, gives us his thoughts about the game and what it's meant to him.
It was always watching Tigres del Licey, Águilas Cibaeña, and if you want a little context, it could be going to see the Yankees and the Red Sox. 20,000 people in the stands. Very, very loud crowd. It's fun. It's with the family. It's with friends. For us, it's an outing. There's all kinds of food. There's all kinds of beverages. There's all kinds of conversations. It's not just a game. That's one of the reasons you will see a lot of the Latino players play the way they play. You know, with the passion that Latinos bring to the game. And that same passion you have to do as an announcer when you're calling the game.
A lo profundo!
Fans from us, you know, early age, went to the stadium, fell in love with the sport, and they're going to follow that sport for as long as they live. There's a huge sense of pride also when it comes to me as Dominican going to Fenway Park and Big Papi comes to bat and he hit a grand slam. And I said, yeah, I turn around and tell my American friends, oh, by the way, he's Dominican. Here in the United States, you know, they want to see a faster game and they want to implement newer things. And we Latinos, from my experience, especially in baseball, we want to enjoy the moment. When I turn the TV on, when I go to a game, I want to forget about, you know, what's going on outside the stadium, outside my house, and let me enjoy this beautiful game for 9 innings. And if it goes extra innings, even better. Because I want to be able to sit down and go back to my roots where things were slow. Let's savor the moment.
Lanzamiento. Conecta la pasa largo por el centro. La trata el center. Aquí viene el físico.
So, Michael, it seems like whenever we look deep into the history of something here in the United States, we always discover that Latinos have been a part of whatever it is from the very beginning, and that we've played a much more important role than most people even know. And obviously, baseball is no exception.
Yeah. There's this sort of famous idea that culturally, baseball always has been ahead of the rest of the United States. Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier 18 years before Martin Luther King marched on Selma. I mean, that's the most obvious example. And now there's this projection that by the year 2050, Latinos are going to be 25% of the American population. But in baseball, that's already the case. So we should keep our eye on baseball because as baseball goes, so goes the nation.
You know, Michael, viva baseball. Thanks for your work, Michael.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Latino USA was produced by Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Julia Alsop. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our Latino USA summer interns are Gabriela Sierra Alonso, Isabel Rio Frio, Polly Dinetclaw, and Nomin Ujiadine. Our futuro interns are Madeline Johnson, Sayer Devlin, and Francesca Santana. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen, and special thanks this week to Brad Horn, Joe Kioski, Gabriela Nunez, Jonathan Miller, and Will Chase. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
We're family. I think we're at a bar. Like, it's not like I take my daughter to bars.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to make education more affordable for students and flexible for teachers through open educational resources, online at hewlett.org. And Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. This is NPR.